This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. Through much of the Vietnam War, Gloria Emerson was one of the lions of American journalism, an unrelenting witness to the graphic horrors being played out on the Indochinese Peninsula. Her 1977 book on the impact of the war on Americans, called Winners and Losers, won her a National Book Award and a lasting place in American social history. Then, in 1989, Gloria Emerson returned to the territory of suffering and death, to the Gaza Strip, one of the Palestinian homelands which, since 1967, has been under Israeli military occupation. Her book about this latest journey is called Gaza, A Year in the Intifada. Gloria Emerson, why did you write this book?
I don't know why. I didn't know why, but the real reason is I'd seen Palestinian camps in Lebanon 30 years before and just shut it out of my mind and thought, I cannot begin to write about the Palestinians. It's too complicated. It will make too many people angry. It's too difficult a subject. And then when the uprising began in December 1987, of course, I was watching it on television. And oddly enough, it was the reporting of my old friend from Vietnam, Bob Simon, of CBS, and especially from Gaza, that made me think, I have to overcome this need not to know. I will make one last effort. I will go into the world of Palestinians, and I will write a record. I will write about a resistance that continues, even if we don't hear about it. I will write about an occupation. You see, I'd never seen an occupation. I'd seen four wars, but not an occupation.
Well, you stayed in a small hotel called the Marna
Hotel.
House.
Right? Yes.
And that was a focal point, I gather, for much that is going on in Gaza.
Well, it's the focal point for the upper middle class and people who are hired to lead the delegations around. To understand Gaza, I think you have to go into the camps, and two of the camps in town are called Beach Camp or Shati and Jabalia. And the Palestinians have a very vocal culture. So although interviews sometimes lasted as long as 5 to 6 hours, it was a pleasure to hear how they used language. Arabic is a language of expression, not always a language of fact. And they speak with great poetry. And it may be too sugary for American taste, but I find it quite stunning.
Well, give us some pictures of what you saw there, of these people, of the woman who ran this hotel, of the people who you met in these camps, and their life like?
I remember one interview with a very sort of slender, rather fierce-looking young man with a beard and a rather wild look in his eyes, and I was quite timid in his presence. He had earned a living as a tailor, and his wife helped him. And he lived in Beach Camp, and he had this most wretched story to tell. He had been in prison. This is a mark of honor, not a mark of criminality. And one night, his small daughter was running a very high fever, so the tailor was anxious to get her to a hospital. And a neighbor in this densely crowded camp said, "Look, I think I see an ambulance." You know, sometimes Red Crescent, the Red Cross, would send ambulances around at night. And, of course, there's always a curfew. And the man rushed out thinking there might be an ambulance circling around, that he could take the child to the hospital. And he was shot by an Israeli soldier. By violating the curfew, although he was holding the child up in clear view. He was shot by the Israeli soldier and had a very severe fracture. Then the worst thing is that he didn't recover very well. He lacked calcium. He was a bad patient. Then he got a summons to appear in court for violating the curfew. Now, I found this the most startling story. A great wrong was done to him. The soldier must have seen the child. He shot the man holding the child. And then the poor tailor, with a badly fractured leg, received a summons to appear in court. And the violation was, of course, that he had broken the curfew. And the curfew is a deadly thing. You step out of your door at night, as one man did after a quarrel with his wife, to smoke a cigarette and calm down, sort of cool off period, just outside his own door in Beach Camp. And three Israeli soldiers set upon him and you could hear the screaming, and no one dared move.
Now you witnessed this.
I did not witness it. I was, shall we say, in the vicinity. I heard the screaming and wanted to go out and was prevented, because if I did, then it would mean trouble for the family I had been spending the night with. So one, you know, sort of one quickly sees how deformed the lives of Palestinians are, and that there is no justice, and that it's a very cruel army of occupation, almost an angry army.
Did you talk to the Israeli authorities about this case?
No, I did not. I stayed out of their view. Remember, I went there alone. I wasn't Miss Emerson of the New York Times or Miss Emerson on assignment for a magazine. I was just Miss Emerson. And in order to get the Palestinian side of it, I did not wish to be seen talking to the Israelis. This is just a book about the Palestinian perspective. And what they say, of course, every time I wrote about an incident, I checked it 14 times with eyewitnesses. The Israeli soldier may have been frightened of the dark. The tailor is frightened of the dark. The child was frightened of the dark. But it was tragic, and it seemed to be incredibly illustrative of the degraded lives that men lead in Gaza. It's harder for them than for the women.
Do you think the Palestinian leaders or their Arab allies in the Middle East, do you think they hold any responsibility for the horrible situations you've described facing Palestinians?
I think that the Palestinians believe the promise, but there has not been anyone who gave them any confidence, and they're quite bitter about it since President Nasser of Egypt. Middle-aged men in Gaza often told me how they had been betrayed by their Arab brothers, so that they have this feeling of sort of isolation and helplessness, and they don't support these feelings with great tolerance. And their children, of course, will support them with even less tolerance. The book is only a small record about pain and suffering and resistance and this vision that they seem to have in Gaza of a homeland. And I had never covered an occupation, as I said, and found it so depressing and so frightening to see people whose heads must be slightly bowed at all times. After a while, I began to realize how men kept certain blank expressions on their face, because if you have too sullen or hostile an expression, you could be called over. You realize, of course, that if you're a Gazan, you can be arrested, no charges, no habeas corpus, and sent to prison for a year. It's known as an administrative detainee, and it was a practice started by the British during their mandate in Palestine. And then when the year is up, still you don't know the reason why, your sentence can be prolonged even further.
Do you think the Palestinians have been well served by their leaders, principally in the PLO?
I have not met Yasser Arafat, and I do not wish to speak on his behalf. He puzzles me.
But you've been there, and you're in a position to evaluate the leadership and how well it has served the Palestinian cause.
The Gazans are fiercely independent. They're subversives in the eyes of the Israelis. They're mutinous. We never talked of Yasser Arafat. What we talked about was their deep allegiance to the PLO. The PLO is not outside them. The PLO is their skin. It's their heart. Look, you see, I'm talking like a Palestinian. And there were pictures of Yasser Arafat put up all through the town of Gaza, quite illegal, of course. And I think whoever is the head of the PLO will be a symbol to them of the struggle. No, I don't think they've been particularly well served at all. But they are a remarkable people, and they are stoic and resourceful. I was very interested in how they carried on their resistance. And a very small example is a woman knitted the Palestinian flag, which is forbidden, and made a wristband for the baby. And I only noticed that because so many people leaned over the fat wrist of the baby to kiss it. And, of course, they were kissing the flag.
My guest is Gloria Emerson. She is the author of a new book called Gaza, A Year in the Intifada. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Gloria Emerson is my guest. She has been a longtime war correspondent for the New York Times in the 1950s and 60s, And most recently, in the Gaza Strip, a homeland to the Palestinians, you write about a Palestinian lawyer, Raji Surani.
Yes.
Who is he?
He's a remarkable man who is now 36. He recently spent 6 months in New York at Columbia on a fellowship, and it wasn't till he came to this country that I realized how strange freedom was to him, how he'd been arrested 4 times. And he is quite pure, you see. He didn't want to join the armed wing of Fatah or any other group. He believes in the law, and he persists in going to defend Palestinian prisoners in the Israeli military courts, which, as we all know, is a completely futile business. But he believes in the law, and he persists in this, and he wants to hold in Israeli courts the Israeli army to account. And it's quite a remarkable and futile task, but he persists, and thus he becomes a rather heroic man in my eyes. He was treated badly by the Shin Bet, the Israeli FBI, so to speak, and was badly beaten and has suffered from headaches. So I took him myself at my own expense to a neurologist who said he had scar tissue on the right side of his brain, possibly from blows.
You know, there have been many reports that Raji Sarani's work is financed by the PLO.
Well, actually, it's not. And it would be better for him if it was, but it's not.
How you say that in the book, and you quote him as saying where his money comes from. But how do you know? As a journalist, how did you determine who
Because
finances
I talked
him?
To his mother, who knows everything. You can always go to a Palestinian mother, and she will fully inform you. And anyway, I attributed the quote to him, and I really didn't find it important where the financing came from. It's not a huge, swanky law firm. It doesn't even have a computer or enough telephones. It's a series of dingy rooms and very involved lawyers. They work in minimal conditions. It's quite shocking.
But I'm actually asking you a kind of journalistic technique question here, because actually in the book you say that it's not in quotations when you say that he is not financed by the PLO or any other organizations. It's in your language, but as a journalist, not as a person of faith in these.
Well, I think there are some.
How did you know it? It's a question that comes up. Many reviewers have brought this up about the book. How do you really know the things that you're being the things you're being told by these Palestinian people are true?
In most cases, when people, as in the case of the tailor, said he had been shot, I went and saw his medical records and had them translated, talked to the doctor who treated him, talked to 6 eyewitnesses, talked to him, and talked to the 6 eyewitnesses independently. In the case of Raji Sarani, I was able to verify that the PLO does not give him any money, but I deeply regret to say that I cannot tell you how I found that out. And it doesn't matter to me whether it's true or not true. He may take some private clients. He may take private contributions from other Arabs. And he may use some income from his own land. But since I no longer work for the New York Times, I do not have to stand behind that. And I don't think it's important. And I know that he does not take money from the PLO. Perhaps it would be better if he did. Most lawyers in Gaza do. I don't see anything criminal with this. It just so happens he doesn't.
It's not a question of whether it's criminal or not. It's a question of how you come to believe how you come to sort out amongst all of these stories.
His English is very good. Well, I mean, I'm sorry you picked on this small point.
I
really cannot reveal how I confirmed this, and I'm sorry, but I can say in other cases the book may contain inaccuracies of one kind or another. But I would say if there are inaccuracies, it's still an extremely truthful book, and it took a very long time to report.
Yet we never meet. See, the thing is, we never seem to meet an Israeli on his or her own terms. I think of this in somewhat this same context as Stephen Kinzer's recent book about Nicaragua, where we meet Contras and Sandinistas, and we find ourselves inside the souls of each and wrestle with the sort of passionate complexities and the evil that they face. And yet in your book, the only sense of an Israeli is through the mouth of a Palestinian who has been beaten. Even when that Palestinian says something nice about an Israeli, we never seem to have a sense of an Israeli human being whom you would really like. And apparently you didn't talk to many of them.
I talked to many Israelis in Tel Aviv, and I saw many examples of cruelty. And in some cases, I did not include them in the book because I'd arrived too late or turned my head away. I'm sorry you feel this way. There is a table that gives the casualties that the United Nations Relief and Works Agency provided, and these numbers are probably too low. I don't think it's a question of evil. I think probably Israeli troops don't like going to Gaza and are often angry and impatient. I myself saw a group of Arab women. I was in a taxi cab coming back to Gaza, whose sons had just been arrested, standing outside the compound of Gaza Central Jail, for example, crying and pleading, and then a truck went by with their sons in it, and then Israeli soldiers came running out to chase the women. It was a very small anecdote. And I said to the women, run, run, run. And then the soldiers chased them, and I don't think this was evil, but I still found it very disturbing. And because so little is known about the Palestinians, and because they're always sort of thought of as a subspecies or mad dog terrorist, I thought it would be interesting not to paint a huge canvas, as David Shipler did in his extraordinary book, Arab and Jew, Wounded Spirits in the Promised Land, but to write a very small book about a short period of time and what the Palestinian perspective was. I could not have written Tom Friedman's book, and I could not have written David Shipler's wonderful book. I wanted to do something quite different, just a very small narrative record of how Palestinians see themselves and their lives and their fate.
When you were in Gaza, you say you didn't, as a rule, talk to Israeli soldiers.
I did not wish to come to their attention.
But what were you afraid of?
Israeli soldiers are not particularly cordial to the American press. In fact, they feel that they have helped the Arabs very much. There's some bitterness there. And I did not want to be taken to headquarters, and I did not want to be searched, and I didn't want my notebooks looked at, because I have changed some names in the book, as is apparent when one reads it, and I did not want them to find the real names of people in my notebooks. And so I tried to stay out of their way. And they could have easily sent me out of there. I mean, they can do anything. I want to just read you something, if I may, in reply to your early charges that I did not talk to the Israelis, and this may be a fault. This is a piece by a correspondent, an American Jew named Hal Weiner, and it was in the New York Times on Sunday in October 1989. And he writes, as difficult as it may be to believe, most stories on the Intifada that appear in the Western media are characterized not by exaggeration, but by understatement. In spite of this, many non-Jewish correspondents have had to deal with accusations of anti-Semitism, while Jewish journalists, myself included, are censured for self-hatred. And then he makes the point that we all know that people who nurse a hatred of Jews generally do so on the basis of long-standing prejudice, not because of anything the Jews themselves do or do not do. And he says in this remarkable piece that since anti-Semitism has its roots not in the truth but in distortions of the truth, I do not see how I can any way do a service to the Jewish people by concealing or distorting the truth when it comes to Israel. I am not prepared to sacrifice my own values as a concession to anti-Semites. The issue is not self-hatred but self-respect. I think I did not mean to portray the Israelis as evil. I think there's a danger that all armies of occupation can be menacing to the civilian population. But I think, as David Shipler has made so remarkably clear in his fine book, there is both a similarity and a hatred. I'm sure the Israeli troops hate being in Gaza, and I'm also sure that they do things that they regret. I did not mean to imply that thousands and thousands of men set out every day to commit atrocities, but tempers do run high, and these are not two armed camps facing each other. One is a civilian population, and the other is a very well-equipped army that is completely in power.
I think often when people are in very violent situations, the question of what your role as a journalist is gets very complicated. You speak of urging, at one point, of urging the women to run for their safety. How do you think of yourself as a journalist now?
I think of myself as a writer and one who wishes to report. I told the women to run because they were middle-aged and I could see the troops coming closer. And they were sort of frozen and I didn't think it was a fair match. And so they perhaps didn't understand when I said, oh, run, run. But they understood the wave of my hand and they began this sort of shuffle. It wasn't a very pretty picture. I don't think you yourself would have liked to have been there. And they ran and the soldiers chased after them. It's a small vignette. It's no more than that.
It's a very human response. And it's one that journalists frequently face as to how they should comport themselves to maintain the relationship that they will eventually have with their readers.
But you see, I work for myself. And I don't believe you can be an ethical or honorable human being if you stand by and watch something of that nature occur without trying to help.
You've traveled in Israel, of course.
Yes.
What is
most happily, and I've even found a kibbutz in Galilee where I would like to spend my declining years, but I'm afraid they won't have me. I said to them, kibbutz Afikim, I could put out a newsletter, and they just laughed. I had a lovely time there.
My guest has been Gloria Emerson. Her new book is called Gaza, A Year in the Intifada. This is Fresh Air.